RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
Since euthanasia was legalised in New Zealand in November 2021, concerns have arisen about its implementation and potential for expansion. While supporters argue it provides a compassionate choice for those facing terminal illness, significant issues undermine confidence in the system. We're talking about this because there is an effort, and we talked to Todd Stevenson of ACT, it's his private member's bill, to, well, expand the End of Life Act. And to talk about this morning is RCR's very own Simon O'Connor. He was a parliamentarian when the original End of Life Act was passed. Morning, Simon. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Paul. Good to join you.
I find this a very fraught thing, to talk about, even to think about. And we had Grant Illingworth, QC, got to get that out of my system, last year. And we were talking about the current act and how it was sort of loose. Now, I won't go into all the details, but it had creep potential, let's say. How do you think about end of life in this way, Simon? What are your views?
Yeah, well, look, to declare my hand, I've always been very anti-euthanasia, was probably one of the leading members of parliament, along with the likes of Maggie Barry, who fought and opposed the law. I used to chair the health committee many years ago when we actually did what was the largest investigation into euthanasia. So better just to clear my cards on the table.
Yep,
but look,
it.
I mean, fundamentally, the current law is not working as well as proponents put forward. You'll hear a lot of them saying it's worked perfectly. There's no problems. And the second thing, and we can delve into that, and the second thing is they often say, look, you know, there's no slippery slope. I mean, that's what happened when we were debating the parliament. Oh, there's no issues here. It's tight. It's easy. No issues at all. Well, it's expanding. They want to expand it. You just mentioned you had an ACT MP promoting a change. They are always going to keep expanding this, because once you accept euthanasia, once you say that it's okay for some people to seek the state's permission to end their life, where do you draw the line? And I would argue you can't draw the line easily, actually, and it will just ever expand.
Yeah, so from a deep philosophical point of view, Simon, and I hear what you say, so we know where you're coming from, but understand the feel of the argument. If you're in a terminal condition, you're suffering horrible pain, all of that, and I've been in that situation. I know what horrible pain's like. I know what looking down the barrel of the end could be like, but I never got that far. So I kind of understand where people can find themselves. Is that enough to cross a line?
Not to change the law. And I think this is something that I'd certainly encourage listeners to think about. We can all think of dreadful cases where we completely understand why someone would want to end their life. And there'll be listeners who have had family members, close friends in that situation. You know, think of the likes of motor neuron disease, Huntington's and so on. But I would still argue you don't change the law, because that once you have, as New Zealand has done and Canada and the Netherlands, you don't just capture those really hard, difficult, emotional cases. You now begin to affect some of the most vulnerable in society. And so, you know, particularly older people facing the end of their life, it's a depressive, emotional time for many. Those in our disability community, Paul, would often say that they feel this pressure, a lot of pressure around the value of their lives. And then, of course, there's always the example of coercion. You know, family members are not always the most noble, generous to their parents at the end of life. I'm not saying it all in every case, but once you change the law, you capture not just the difficult cases, but every case.
I could see how a persuasive argument could be made to someone like, well, you know, it's not looking good and you've got the house there and, you know, you could sell the house and,
well,
you know what I'm saying.
I've joked before. So I used to do a lot of hospital and hospice chaplaincy over, you know, in former life and career. And long and short, I joke, where there's a will, there's a family. And again, that's not in every case, but there's enough where actually mum or dad moving off the mortal coil swifter than anticipated is beneficial. They're chewing up money. I mean, God, it's like $1,000, $2,000 a week to keep someone in a retirement home and hospital care. They're chewing into the assets. Just move them on. They have a terrible life. So this does happen, or there's the potential for it to happen. And are we as a society happy to have a law that facilitates that?
Okay. Should others be taking part in delivering the service? What are the morals of that, do you think?
Well, I think it's one of the paradoxes or ironies in a lot of this debate. I mean, I'm often, you know, as someone who's pretty vocal into these ethical issues, I often hear people saying, well, Simon, it's my choice. If I want to exercise this choice, you bugger off out of it. You can choose it or not. But the irony with euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide or end-of-life care, whatever we want to call it, is by its nature, it's not the individual's choice. That they're seeking the both, I don't know, permission of the state, of the government of the day, but they're also seeking medical help. They need doctors and nurses to do this for them. So you can exercise the choice individually, but you still require others to be involved. And I think I've got the stats right. The majority of New Zealanders seeking end-of-life choice or euthanasia are seeking the doctor to effectively inject them with the substances. I can't name them. I think I get fined or go to prison. Let's not do that on air, but they still expect the doctor or the nurse to do, if you will, the termination. They don't choose to ingest the pills or the substances themselves. That's actually an option in New Zealand. You can do it yourself or you can get someone to help you. And most Kiwis choose someone to help them. So again, it's just not completely their individual choice.
Yeah, there's something not quite right about that in my mind, because you, especially in this case, in your life, really, you have to take full responsibility, don't you? I mean, if there's anything in life to take full responsibility for, that would be it. And medicalizing a death like that is interesting as well, because everything's being medicalized now, including that. So, you know, why the doctor? Is he going to do it any better?
Yeah, well, that's been put forward. I remember when we had the inquiry in Parliament, you know, someone pointed out, why not just your lawyer or your real estate agent do it? You know, it's not that difficult. In anyone. Yeah. But you're right, there is that medicalization. To be fair, some of the counter arguments is when someone is in such a state of pain or trauma, disability, or debilitated because of a cancer or something like motor neuron disease, they're not capable of ending their lives. That's sort of the counter argument there. I still don't think it's the right choice. You know, the phrase that they use in the UK, one of the organizations, is care, not killing. In other words, we need to provide more care and support, not actually terminate a life.
Let's talk about some of the issues here around this, how the law is functioning. I've got here a bit of a list. Inaccurate reporting, though we have seen that over 1,000, I think you might have mentioned the stat just before. The Ministry of Health's data on euthanasia deaths and applications contain discrepancies, with numbers in quarterly reports not matching the annual report, etc.
Yeah, so the ministry does a quarterly report and the ministry does an annual report, but when you add up all their numbers, they don't match. I think there's 3 deaths out and a total of 13 applications. The ministry has come and said, oh, look, I think they called it a validation error. And look, people get stats wrong, but I suppose my point there, and I was, you know, public about this, is we're talking life and death here. You know, we're not talking 3 peanuts missing from the jar. We're talking three human lives. Mm. If the ministry can't even add its numbers up, what else is it missing? I suppose that's my point.
Lack of psychological assessments. How important is that? That's really important, isn't it?
Oh, vitally important. I mean, it's probably the one that upsets me the most or frustrates me the most. So again, from the ministry's own reporting, only 1% of those seeking euthanasia are put forward or, I'm losing my English all of a sudden, recommended to go and see a psychologist or a psychiatrist or someone just to make sure that their mental disposition is okay, that they're making a conscious choice, and also to remove any doubt of coercion. And for me personally, it's just far too low. The idea that only 1 in 100 people seeking to end their lives need that little bit of extra review seems far too low. And I have to be blunt, I don't trust the 150 or so doctors who are part of euthanasia to have the necessary scope of practice to be able to detect that level of psychological concern or coercion.
Does that mean there could be a group think in this small number here that will always kind of push towards going one way?
I think that's possible. I mean, there's about 20,000 doctors in New Zealand, so that's 20,000. And as best we know, about 150 are prepared to do euthanasia. So you're talking less than 1% of doctors. So that could have a little bit of a bias. But I suppose my fundamental point is that the doctors are probably not psychologists. No. A lot of them will be in the likes of anaesthetists because they know how to use these drugs, and that they're not bad people. They just won't necessarily have the training, Paul, to understand the psychological pressures. And my point ultimately is that only 1% of those seeking euthanasia, that only 1% get referred on, says either the doctors are missing completely or ignoring some of the symptoms. Because let's not forget, we're told repeatedly we have a mental health problem in this country, and we do. And yet somehow we're being told that when someone's at the end of their life, they're probably depressed, anxious, worried, upset, all of that, that these doctors are, oh, no, they're perfectly fine. There's no issues here. We don't need to double-check their psychological state. You know, we're going to sign off 99 out of 100 people. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Because we do procedures. It's a proceduralized way of thinking.
Oh, very much so. And look, it's one of my, again, I've got my strong views on this topic, but, you know, the euthanasia law is about 28 pages, I think, including the title page and the index. It's really a set of processes and reporting mechanisms. There aren't actually, I would argue, that many safeguards. If you actually read the law, it's a lot of processes, a lot of boxes to be checked. And that's what keeps the doctors safe. As long as they've talked to you, referred the notes on to another doctor, they say, yep, we can end this person's life, file the forms, all's tickety-boo. So, yeah, it is very process-driven.
Palliative care. Surely that can make a huge difference in most cases, I would have thought.
Yeah, look, I'm a great fan of palliative care. I had a bill in the ballot before I left Parliament actually seeking lots more funding. As most people know, if you've got a hospice, close, you know, they're always doing fundraisers, bake sales. They've got their secondhand shop because they don't get much government funding. Yeah. Euthanasia is fully funded. Palliative care is not. And I just think that's terrible, to be honest, Paul. And that's a problem of successive governments to have not funded it. And look, they can do most care. Like, it's just in the most extreme cases that palliative care cannot assist. And, you know, I think more New Zealanders would benefit from better and earlier access to palliative care.
I think you've also identified understaffed review committee.
Yeah. So the law says that there needs to be a committee of three people to review all the euthanasia cases. There should be a doctor, a nurse, and an ethicist in effect. And since the law came into effect, they have really struggled to find three people continuously. I think it's only around July this year that they have filled it again. So for me, it's, again, how is it that we can't even find three people to sit on a review panel? And again, a review panel around an enormous power that's been granted, which is that doctors are able to legally terminate a person's life early. In any other situation, they'd go to prison. In this case, yep, they're allowed to do it, and yet they can't even consistently fully man. Now, I was trying to avoid that word, person. Yeah. Person the committee.
Person the committee. Can't get enough persons. Okay, so expansion. Look to other countries. I've heard that in places like Canada, you can be depressed and kind of go through this. And how many people are, you know, in that way? Also, the Netherlands, I think, are pretty loose or liberal with this as well.
Netherlands, yeah, very, very much so. The Netherlands has been operating euthanasia for a long, long time, and it's very much expanded from terminal illness to then a wider range of conditions, and now mental health. We've had people who have been, in a sense, young and suicidal, who have been allowed to euthanize because they've basically said, I'm still too stressed out. Canada's going down a very similar realm. It's that mental health side in particular that catches people. I think most of us can, you know, even someone like myself who disagrees with euthanasia, can conceptualize that physical pain. But once you're in the mental health area, it becomes much more difficult. But you just see expansion as the fundamental point is there are difficult cases. There always are, but there's always going to be the next difficult case. And, you know, once you open the door to euthanasia, as New Zealand has done, where do you draw the line? And myself and others warned that there would be expansion, and here we are. We're having a review. Mm. David Seymour's keen to see it expand. He's been on the public record about that. We have now a members bill looking to expand. And in 2 or 3 years, we'll be back here again. The next set of hard cases, we've got to expand it further, change the age, change eligibility. It won't stop.
What about how do we pay for superannuation going forward without this?
Well, it's one of the arguments that it gets spun out. In fact, actually, David Farah put it on his blog in some ways a week or so ago in reaction to actually something I'd written on Substack. We was pointing out, you know, it's only about $1,087 to pay for euthanasia, and it's a lot more for funding palliative care. And that brings that rather insidious mindset that, you know, we could ultimately save ourselves a lot of money if people who are very, very ill can just be guided out the door. And I better be clear, no one's suggesting here an involuntary euthanasia. We're not saying about forcing people. But, you know, if we're going to go down that line of saving money, and it's a powerful argument, it's always very attractive to some. It starts with encouraging people to consider euthanasia. And there are those, Paul, arguing already that doctors should be allowed to tell patients about it, to encourage them. At the moment, they're not allowed to.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take long to just say, hey, actually, this group of people, they're in comas, they've got serious issues. It might just be easier just to let them go. It saves.
Or Alzheimer's or something like that.
Yeah. You can see where it could end. I stress the word could. Yeah. Could.
Here's a bit of a different question, because I often wonder about this. What does it do to the soul if you end in this way? What do you reckon? I mean, I think it's something people should think about.
Well, the theologian in me, so people are trained in theology, in my case from a Christian perspective. Well, 2 points to make. One is, If one believes in a creator God, if God exists and someone who creates life and creation, he's probably going to take a pretty dim view someone ending his creation. But I would put the rider in really, really swiftly that it's always hard for us to judge the intents or intentions of people. In other words, I'm certainly not someone who wants to condemn or heavily judge, but we just don't know what
neither am I.
Nor are you.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just curious on if it's a bigger picture, where that fits in, you know.
Well, it could be an awkward conversation at the pearly gates. Oh, you're here a little bit early.
Yeah.
I shouldn't joke about it. It's a serious topic.
Scheduled to turn up for another year, or something like that, right.
But look, the great religions, not just Christianity, the great religions of the world, doesn't matter if it's Judaism, Islam, I assume Buddhism as well, certainly Christianity, have a real issue with the premature ending of one's life. There's pretty strong prohibitions around that. And a lot of it comes back to the idea of if God creates, he brings into being and he lets die, then we leave it to him or whoever the entity, the God entity is.
I got one more on that level.
All right. We'll end on high.
Suffering. Suffering. I know humans can take incredible suffering. I know that. But is that, to understand suffering, and some people have worse than others, but there are always moments in our life where we suffer badly. Let's say it might be right at the end for many. To miss out on that extreme, is there anything in that?
Look, I think there is. I mean, first and foremost, none of us want suffering. None of us want to suffer. None of us wants our loved one, anyone, to suffer. It's heartrending when we see it. But I would suggest that suffering is part of the human condition. It's unavoidable. And then in this particular debating space, I know I've said it earlier, but there's always the next hardest case. And so, we can draw out examples of terrible, terrible suffering, and a lot of us can appreciate that. But then, what about a case that's not quite as dramatic? What I'm really trying to say is, where do you draw the line about where is suffering okay or not? And, you know, the real we all sit back and go, okay, the 87-year-old with motor neuron disease, what a terrible situation. But actually the euthanasia law in New Zealand says it's suffering that you deem intolerable. There's no objective test. So what about the 24-year-old who's just had enough of life? They would argue they're suffering. Why would we not allow them the choice? And so these are the fraught questions which I would argue the pro-euthanasia camp always tries to avoid, because suffering is not an objective test. We all suffer in different ways.
Yeah. Do you want to make your conclusion, Mr. O'Connor, at the end of this chat? Do you want to sum it up beautifully right at the end?
Look, ultimately, no matter what, you know, listeners think about euthanasia, whether they think it's a good or a bad thing, just appreciate that the current law isn't working as smoothly as people would suggest. And I'd also point out that the warnings 3 years ago that this would create a slippery slope are proven true. The very fact that we're talking about it, there are bills in the ballot, politicians want to expand it, there's your slippery slope. And listeners just have to ask, where does it end?
All right. Good to have you on, Simon. And that depth of knowledge is fantastic. I believe that you're going to be heading this way. Is that right? Queenstown Way, someone told me?
Oh, you've outed me. You've outed me. Yes, Rachel and I are coming down a mixture of RCR and holiday. So we're going to do live out of the studio, covering another host's show and then spending just a couple of days relaxing. So you're going to have to give me some advice. In fact, listeners might have to give me some advice. Where does one go in Queenstown and Arrowtown?
Well, you avoid Queenstown. That's number one. If you don't like traffic issues, I know enough to tell you a few things. Dave is pretty good with that now. And I'll show you how to drive the truck when you get in, the digital truck. So looking forward to catching up in studio with you. Simon, thanks for coming on this morning. Speak Free on Friday. We'll see you soon. Thanks.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.